this week on Out of the Air features interviews with the co-directors, producers Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt on Ken Burns' 12-part documentary on PBS American Revolution, discussing their own background and careers in documentary filmmaking. Our spotlights on the builder and performer of his own experimental musical instruments, Joe Rowan, in concert March 5th at Elastic Arts in Chicago.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight, back again after his May 29, 2020 interview. You can listen to that on our website, is Joe Rowan, and he's going to talk about an event coming up where he is performing, and we haven't had him on, though, but he'll talk a little bit about the unique instruments he has, an arsenal of one-of-a-kind instruments that he plays on, like banjos, clarinets, but they're not exactly what you'd get off the showroom store. Joe, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Aloha, everyone.
Yeah, aloha, Joe. Thank you for remembering.
Well, tell a little bit about the instruments that you use. They're definitely unique. They're never one of a kind. And I know you perform all around the area here in Northwest Indiana. And then we'll talk about the event coming up at Elastic Arts in Chicago.
Yes, I'm a hybrid artist-musician. And I make my own musical instruments out of things from the hardware store, things from the kitchen, things from the trash can. And they're all fully playable working musical instruments, but they're also beautiful, sculpturesque, and sometimes bizarre creations. And so I've got an arsenal of about 24 of those, and I perform compositions and improvisations for willing audiences wherever they'll have me.
What has been your most current instrument creation?
Well, I've got something that I don't know exactly what it is, but it's made out of like a conga and a speaker cone, and it's got a hockey stick and cane for multiple necks and a part of a ceiling fan. I have this part of a ceiling fan that I've just been dying to use forever, and I think it's finally ready to be implemented. So that's a representative sample of the sort of things I make.
Do you ever sell your instruments? I mean, do someone say, "Oh, I really would like to have that instrument"?
Sometimes people do, but what I really want is for people to make their own musical instrument, because I like to, it's a kind of a collage, and I see things that catch my eye and I say, I'd really like to have that as a playable thing. I tell people, you do that, go find something that catches your fancy and see what it speaks to you, you know, that it wants to become, rather than just buying mine.
So how long does it take you to conceive of? I guess you don't design the instrument so much as you create it out of whatever materials you have. But tell us about that process.
I would not say I design them. I think of them as improvisations. And this is kind of at the heart of my practice, is that I've been very interested in improvised music. I was a student at the Berklee College of Music, and I studied jazz. And so the art of improvisation, you know, is explored in the context of jazz. And there is something kind of nagging at me about whether or not you could, you know, improvise the instrument, for example. Could, you know, if you could improvise the music, could you improvise the concert, or could you improvise the instrument, or could the audience be improvised? You know, what were the boundaries of the improvisation? So I think of these instruments as improvised, and in the same way that for example, jazz is improvised on a form. You might take a written piece of music, and then you extrapolate and you find parts that get passed back and forth. That's sort of what I do with instruments. I find, you know, if a ceiling fan catches my fancy, I don't claim to have invented the ceiling fan, but I say, okay, what can I add and what can I play with? And is there something else that mirrors the form of the ceiling fan, you know, so that there's elements of repetition? So they're kind of improvisations in physical space.
Well, and that particular one sounds very large. Is this one that sort of is on the floor and you play it like a bass or something, or a cello?
No, I it's particularly fun when an instrument is awkward and unwieldy when I still wear it, because I think it gives people a sense of the physicality. I've got some that are enormous, and whenever I heave one of those things up onto my shoulder and I'm sort of dwarfed by the size of it, you know, I can see the reaction in the audience that it goes from being sort of a abstract thing that people see, oh, it's got weight, it's got heft, and now he's going to have to contend with that. You know, they may be sort of like watching a juggler. They think, like, well, is he going to...
kind of like Dick Van Dyke. It's your Dick Van Dyke moment.
Yeah.
Now, you perform all around the area, and we'll very briefly here hit on the thing in Chicago, but where are some places that you performed in Northwest Indiana and nearby?
Let's see. They just had me at South Shore Arts at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in December. That was a lot of fun. And I made my Paul Henry's debut not too long ago. I've been kind of a hangers-on at Paul Henry's for a long time, but they finally had me for basically my own night. So that was a lot of fun. And I've been, at the Art Barn. And where else have I been in Northwest Indiana? I guess those are some of the most well-known places. As many of the local libraries, I've been checking off the libraries one by one in the Lake County system. So that's always a good place to play. People like coming to the library, and I like being there. So,
well, in our final minute here, we want to give you a chance to tell about what you have coming up in Chicago.
Yes, I'll be at Elastic Arts on March 5th for their Thursday night improvised music series. If you're seeing improvised music in Chicago, you're probably already familiar with Elastic Arts, but they're a great hub for improvised music of all kinds. And so I'm going to be joining them for a Thursday night session, me and one other artist to be announced, but me for sure.
That's great. And transporting several of your instruments there and doing that, and it'll be a wonderful evening of music with you. So that's Joe Rowan, and your website is joerowan.com, and you can see your whole schedule there. And again, that's at Elastic Arts in Chicago. That's 429 West Diversity, and it's a Thursday, 8:30, March 5th, and it'll be the Improvised Music Series. Joe, thank you so much for coming out of the air and sharing your musical journey, your special musical journey, and your new performance.
Thanks so much. Hope to see a lot of you there.
Yeah, have a fantastic time.
Thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, with end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation. Emberforge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Clay Jenkinson for Listening to America, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are delighted to welcome Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt to Art on the Air. Sarah and David, along with Ken Burns, are the directors, producers of The American Revolution, a six-part, 12-hour series on PBS. Sarah is an American documentary film producer, and for more than two decades produced some of the most widely watched and acclaimed documentaries on PBS. David has spent his entire career with Ken Burns and Florentine Films. His research on the Vietnam War in 2017 won him the Jane Mercer Footage Researcher of the Year Award. Thank you for both joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Sarah and David. What engaging work you both have done. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Sarah, we'll start with you. We want to know your background story. How I tee that up is how you got from where you were to where you are now. Take us up to a certain point, and then we'll switch over to David and get his story. So tell us all about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in a small rural community in upstate New York. My father's family came here after the Second World War as Jewish refugees, and my mother's family traces her origins back to the Mayflower. So very old-fashioned American story. And I grew up in a really interesting part of upstate New York and ended up at Barnard College, which is a women's college of Columbia University. And I was an American studies major there, really interested in the intersection of art, music, film, literature, and history, and sort of how you look at history through the lens of those other more creative sort of influences and institutions. And my second job ever was going to work for Ken. So I was really lucky very early in my career when I was thinking about going to graduate school. Instead of going to graduate school, I moved to a teeny tiny town in southwestern New Hampshire to work on a big series on the history of jazz, and have worked for Ken for actually, at this point, almost three decades, for 28, 29 years. And the films I've been lucky enough to work on are jazz, the Second World War, Prohibition, Ernest Hemingway, the U.S. and the Holocaust, a Verite film about college and prison, the Vietnam War, and now the American Revolution. And David and I have been really lucky to work together for now more than a decade ourselves. So we're a small family band that sticks together. We've all worked together for a really long time.
Excellent.
Yeah. So in your schooling and in your household growing up, so with this Mayflower connection, was your household steeped in history? Is that what drew you to history? What was school life like? What did you gravitate toward?
Yeah, I think probably my household as a kid was a little bit unusual in terms of its influence on history, probably less from my mom's side than my dad's. I was around a lot of people who came here later in their life in the second half of the 20th century. I grew up on a college campus, so I was around a lot of college students and professors and academics, and always really interested in analyzing things and thinking about how history might inform where we are, and was always very interested in politics, local politics. My mother was on the school board, branching out into, you know, always being on the debate team and playing various characters, both from history and in the present day. So, yeah, I grew up in a house where it was celebrated to be curious and interested and to think about the world around you.
Very good. Well, we'll move on to David and get your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now, and then start talking about, well, your documentary process and, of course, the newest one.
So working on the American Revolution is a little bit of a homecoming story for me. I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia. I worked in Colonial Williamsburg as a little kid up until I was 15 or 16 years old. And also really close to Williamsburg are Jamestown and Yorktown, where the British Empire and what became the United States began, and where that same empire, what became the United States, ended, of course, which is a major story that we tell in the series. Spoiler alert. So I have four older siblings, and my parents are also pretty interested in history, but they just, all of them, all six of them, just really impressed the stories of American history on me. And also it was just around me. I mean, you could walk through Colonial Williamsburg, and not only did you see it, but you could smell it. You could really feel it and hear it. And it was just totally drawn to it. I also, one of my older brothers forced me to watch, I wouldn't even say forced because I was very interested in it, but had me watch Ken Burns' The Civil War when I was too young. I was probably eight when it was re-released in 1995. And I, you know, loved it. would get it on you know, you'd get it at the video store, and it would be, you know, a yard long worth of tapes because it was so many episodes, and I really adored it. I also watched it in high school and middle school even. My history teacher was, you know, into that, and really was a big part of my identity, and my interest was Ken's films. And then I went to Dartmouth College and I watched more of them there. I watched Jazz, Sarah's great baby, in class there, as well as Lewis and Clark and The Civil War Again. So it was just really always there and always drew me. And I was a history major, and I thought, you know, I'd love to tell American history, but I don't think that I'm really going to be able to do that through these essays that I'm writing for, you know, college classes. Can I tell it more dynamically? Can I go to a place like Williamsburg, or could I somehow work for Ken Burns? I graduated in 2009, which was pretty tough time for a lot of my friends to get a job. And I just got really lucky with an internship at Florentine Films. And then that became a job, and I've continued to be very lucky. I've worked very hard, but things have fallen in line for me at the same time, where I got to work on the Roosevelts, was my first job. Then the Vietnam War with Sarah. I got to produce the Benjamin Franklin series with Ken, returning to the 18th century for the first time. And then with Ken and Sarah, creating this epic 12-hour series that took years of our lives to put together on the American Revolution. It's been a real privilege for me.
So what is that timeline of a historical 10-year? I mean, 10 years to create this. What does the timeline look like? Where do you start?
We sort of start at the finish line, actually. We work our way backward from when we think we might want to broadcast in some way, but people love to hear that it really doesn't matter what the subject of the film we're making. Our process is fairly stable and stays the same, whether we're looking at Muhammad Ali, Franklin Roosevelt, Ernest Hemingway, Vietnam, or the American Revolution. We have an extraordinary team. I can lean out my computer screen and see them. Jeff Ward, our incredible writer, starts to read. David, Ken, and I start thinking about who's alive today that's thought and studied the subject. That's the first thing we do. We're new to this topic. Who isn't? A great writer, a great historian, a great person who was alive then, whatever it is, who's going to help us in front of the camera and behind the camera really wrestle the history to the ground? And we just immerse ourselves in the subject matter. And then once we've sort of got our sea legs and started to talk to scholars and writers and thinkers and people, Jeff starts putting pen to paper. We start shooting interviews. Our research team starts to put together kind of big macro wish lists and start to go out and find material. So if you're dealing with the Vietnam War, they're looking at still photographs and newsreel and all the great rock and roll recordings of that time. If you're talking about the American Revolution, we're thinking about paintings and etchings and documents and maps. And it's a completely different type of material that we're bringing in, but the process is the same. And then those people really end up being old-fashioned, really academic, you know, librarians. They're logging everything in with all kinds of detail and all kinds of accuracy. And it's like a very quiet little group of detail-oriented archivists. The editors get all that material. We start to wrestle the narrative to the ground. We start to put interviews into the structure of the film. And it's, you know, for a couple of years, we're editing, we're looking at the stuff, we're bringing more things in, we're having our scholars come look at the film with us. And that's very fluid for a few years. And then we finally get brave enough to kind of lock the narrative and lock the picture. And we go into a really technical phase, which I love. It's not as creative, but it's really fun to make a film look and sound really good and then figure out how to legally get the rights to everything we want to use. So there's a whole very practical, technical aspect that happens to the stuff at the end. And then as Ken always says, you can make a good film, but if no one watches it, what's the point? So we spend a lot of time figuring out how to get the film in front of people, not just in terms of streaming and broadcast, but how to get the film in front of students of every age around the country. So that's sort of our process, regardless of the subject.
Well, and it seems like looking at American Revolution, just comparing it, let's say, to Civil War or some of the other documentaries, and you touched on this already, Sarah, is there's no film, there's no photographs whatsoever. And so I noticed that you had some reenactments in there, which kind of bridged the story because, you know, you need some action things. I mean, and of course, Ken's style was to take a still picture and add motion to it by panning the camera, pulling in and out and everything like that. There's a lot more of that. But, you know, coming up with 12 hours of content for that and everything is difficult. And yet all the material's there. I mean, you have great historians. But when you're doing that, what decisions do you make and say, okay, we need a reenactment here? How do you fit that into the style of the Ken Burns style?
Right. We could both talk about this. I'll just say to begin with that I wish we'd interviewed ourselves at the beginning of the project and how we all felt about reenactments and material from the 20th century and like what we thought the film was going to look like versus what we ended up doing, which really did change over time. So it's good to be flexible and learn as you go, which we really did. Ken has always been fairly allergic to reenactments. And he says often that if you're going to use a lot of reenactments in a documentary, just go make a feature film. So this was really new for all of us. And David had gotten a little bit of his sea legs making the Franklin film. But I feel like going from Ken's notion that reenactments needed to be impressionistic and not incredibly literal really helped us. So and our producer, Megan Ruff, who, you know, spent as much time with your reenactors and Buddy Squires as any of us, like we learned from them. They take their craft really carefully. They're very particular about making sure their uniforms are right and they read the right books and they eat the right food and they are at the right place at the right time. And all that's great for a documentary filmmaker trying to give some impression of what something was like. So I think impressionistic was the word. We don't want to see their faces. We don't want to be too literal. We want to get a sense of motion, a sense of urgency, a sense of formation, a sense of the life they're living and the world that they might have looked out and seen. In terms of that. And then the Living History Museums, as David said, I mean, he knows Colonial Williamsburg better than anyone, but there are a whole bunch of Living History Museums up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And the people who work there were enormously generous to us. So David, just talk a little, you know. David,
sure. I mean, I don't think we can thank enough the reenactors and the Living History Museums, not just them, the archivists, the people who really live this history welcomed us in. They all wanted us to do the best job we could, and they made it easy for us to do the best job we could. So we're really grateful to them. I would say that one thing we learned working on the Benjamin Franklin film is that, you know, this is it's a period that's so long ago that you actually do need to see people in motion to understand what they're actually doing. So in the instance of Benjamin Franklin, he's a printer. Well, what do we know as a printer? What do we know of printing now? We don't really think of letterpress and people, you know, actually the labor that involved. But also you're moving around type with your hands. I mean, that's an incredibly mentally exhausting and physically exhausting thing to do at the same time. You can't just say that. You have to see that. But we could just see hands and arms moving and the movement machine itself and not be distracted by, okay, that's not Benjamin Franklin moving the press. But we were able to adapt that for the Revolutionary War, where there's armies marching hundreds of miles in all sorts of different weather, poorly clothed, unfed, all this stuff. When we're hearing that, it's one thing. But while hearing that, to see the movement of people's legs or the movement of oxes pulling cannons, Or women.
Or yarn being, spun into a ball. That was like very impressive to see. Yeah.
If, you know, the film Sarah worked on World War II, you can see Rosie the Riveter. You can see lots of archival footage that shows the mobilization effort of World War II. The American Revolution was really something that was won on the battlefield, sure, but it was also won on the home front by those women that you're talking about, by craftsmen, by people making the weapons and melting down the.
That was beautiful too, you know, watching the carving of the weapon.
And just like loading up a wagon. I mean, just feeling the human effort that it took to do this war required going out and filming the reenactors. So yes, we didn't have what we might have wanted to do if we were making a film that took place in the 1970s. But in some ways that became a luxury, it became something that made our film better, I think.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I was completely invested in the moment because of those things. I loved the current watercolors along with historical and the reenactment and the historians. You know, it just really kept you so engaged and involved. And I was even like edge of my seat, even though I know the history or I'm aware of the history. You know, it was just very exciting. So, you know, in general, when you know, there were a lot of historians and writers. Do you put out like an international call?
Or? Oh gosh, no. No. One person really leads to another. Honestly, it's very hand sewn the way we do this. We definitely don't. We fly under the radar. We're fairly discreet. We're very quiet. We keep things pretty close to the vest while we're working on the film. And we start with our favorite books, really. Alan Taylor, Jill Lepore introduced us to Jane Kaminsky, who introduced us to Vince Brown. My husband, I think, was a big fan of Bill Hoagland. Both David and my husband are big fans of Christopher Brown, who ended up being in the Franklin film. And then we begged him to do the American Revolution.
And he's grateful he did, by the way.
Yeah, he's grateful that he did. He's done a lot with us. You know, one historian, one essay, one book leads to another. And we're a tiny little band, and we really do kind of sew the films together. Rick Atkinson had been someone that we've admired for a long time. He's written about many of the wars we've made films about in different order. And so it was a intimidating but exciting prospect to get to work with him. And he was an incredible interview and then extremely helpful. He was writing his second volume while we were making the film. And
he had written about World War II and the Vietnam War, but both of those films, Sarah and Ken and Lynn had interviewed witnesses, which he obviously was not a witness of either of those events. I mean, I guess he was alive during the Vietnam War, but wasn't a participant. So they didn't talk to him in the same way that we did for the revolution, because obviously there's nobody who witnessed the revolution who's still alive. And boy, are we grateful for what he contributed. And then another person, I took three classes with Colin Calloway in college at Dartmouth. And I can't express how lucky I am to have had that experience, just because he really opened my mind about how to think about American history, American Indian history. And he was the perfect person to talk about it for this film.
You know, we had Clay Jenkinson on, and we also talked about the interview process a little bit, how that works, you know, how he sits down and everything. So maybe describe, and since he'd already described to us, but I mean, for our audience, when they have someone like him on there who not only does your voiceovers for some of the characters, but actually as a historian is speaking, tell us how that process works when you sit them down and actually film them.
With Clay specifically or
in general?
Yeah, I mean, we try to make people very comfortable. We try to treat it as a conversation, not as a, hey, we need you to help us fill this hole in the script right here. Insert, please say these 10 words. it's really just talking to them about their work, about their book, about their understanding of the characters or the history. Clay is himself a fountain of, you know, everything. We interviewed him for Benjamin Franklin, for the Roosevelts, Thomas Jefferson, possibly some earlier stuff that I can't think of right now.
We didn't interview him for this one. We thought about it. Here's how I do a lot of the interviews. David helps, you know, prep them where it's very collaborative. But I always think I've talked a lot about this in talking about our work, but I really love the art and the act of listening. I think that's really lost in our world. And so we do a lot of preparation going into the interviews. We never go in unprepared on the one hand. On the other hand, we then have a map of questions, but we're really listening so that we can kind of think about what in that moment when you sit down as relaxed and comfortable as everyone is, there's a camera on. It's not a normal conversation. It's not a normal setting. It's not a normal situation. It's really intense. And there's a lot at stake. And so you're both wanting to make sure we get everything that we think we might get from that person, but also listening very carefully to how they're talking about it in that day, in that place, in that moment, which is different. So I think we try to just listen really carefully. And I think of it as going to class with that person, and we get to bring the whole country into Alan Taylor's classroom or Colin Calloway's classroom or Christopher Brown's classroom, and then bring history to life, which is really exciting. So, you know, we're as interested and curious as we hope our viewers are, and we want our viewers to go away excited about a subject and curious about a subject and having lots of questions rather than telling them what we think they should think and feel.
I think the person in the chair recognizes how interested Sarah is, and there's nothing more attractive of a quality when you're trying to express yourself than to see somebody on the other side really cares what you have to say. She is incredible, and it's earnest, but it's incredibly valuable for our production that she has that capacity.
And after a brief pause, Art of the Year will return with our guests today, Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt. Art of the Year listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show, whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners? Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. We'd like to thank you for listening to Art on the Air. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art on the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art on the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you. And we return with our guests today on Art on the Air, Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt from American Revolution, Ken Burns' new film. They're co-directors on it, and you're listening on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Well, the research must be so yummy for you. I mean, I love research. And you really humanize this by adding people that are not in our school books. So the amount of research to bring like the children and, you know, like the home crafts, like we talked about, it's such a full experience. So can you explain your research theories and how you think about it?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is similar to some of the ways that Sarah explained how we might get the people to talk in the chair. You just, you know, pull on a thread and see where it leads you. But I would say reading some of those books that we mentioned earlier, you're going to see a character mentioned briefly who has a one sentence quote really well said. You wonder what else they might have to say. You flip to the back of the book, you find the footnote, you say, oh, wow, this person has a memoir. Let me read the whole thing. You do that. It might lead you to an archive that has several other great volumes of diaries or whatever. You might otherwise be interested in what a certain newspaper was publishing about a certain event and find that. Some of the characters who I had not heard of are relatively well known in the circle of American Revolutionary history. For instance, Joseph Plum Martin, his memoir, which is, I think, the best book written about the Revolutionary War. You know, people at the Museum of the American Revolution know him. They talk about him a lot. He's Alan Taylor's favorite person in history. So he wasn't, I would say, particularly hard to find in the context of this, but he's an incredible character. And then there's other characters that kind of have similar experiences to him in that they were children when the war began. They wrote their experiences well after the war, but this is the formative moment in their own lives and in the life of their country. So John Greenwood, Betsy Ambler are characters that we as a team surfaced as we were going along. Betsy Ambler is a really good example of Sarah and my collaboration because we were not too far along in the edit, but the edit had begun. And she said, I feel like we're missing the perspective of a kid. what have you got? And I was like, I don't know. I know there's not that much written about this. I don't know. And then I was reminded that years and years before I had come across somebody who was from Yorktown, Virginia, which of course is going to be important in our last episode, who wrote about her experiences from a kid. I mean, from like age five, she was involved in what was going on because there was a lot going on in Yorktown, this port, when there's protests of the customs and the imports and all this stuff, and very much was involved with what was going on away from the war, but definitely related to the war from age 10 to 18 of the war years. And so we were able to get the idea of Yorktown seeded in an early episode, but also follow this character who was a child, a woman, who didn't ever see a battle, but was very much affected by this war every day. And I think that is something that she became somebody that I think people today can see themselves in a little bit better than some of the people who are actually on the battlefield, because most of us have not seen a battle.
You know, we did an interview. It's actually one of the professors that's going to be making the presentation here locally. And she brought up several things that I don't think people realize, that the Revolution was actually a pretty hard war. I mean, you hear about Valley Forge and the hardships in a general sense, but it really brought to light that, you know, some of the real severe hardships. And of course, you got smallpox, you know, running around, whether to immunize people. There's some interesting things about that part. And the one thing I was thinking about too is, what ends up in the cutting room floor? You really, I know how filmmaking works, and you especially document and say, okay, we have X amount of hours, but now what gets, how's that decision process go for you guys?
Ken always says, and I think he's right, that filmmaking is subtractive. I think it's also additive. So you're constantly boiling, subtracting, you throw everything in and you get it right. And then you add the stuff that feels like it's missing. I don't personally have scenes in this film that I really, really wish had stayed in. There's kind of calibration of doing more or less of a certain things. There, you know, I'm particularly interested in the politics piece of it. So I always lean toward those moments, hearing from the founders, how they debated, what they were thinking. You know, some of the other people really love the military stuff, and I don't know that as well, and I don't understand it as well. I think, you know, it's been really cold in the Northeast. We've had a lot of snow. It's been really brutal. And I was saying to my daughter, who's 15, I picked her up from music school because she was like, I don't want to walk in the snow and it's icy and the rain. And I was like, no problem, I'll pick you up. And I was like, imagine the winter of 1778. It's unbelievably cold. You know, the Hudson River is frozen right now in big sections where it normally doesn't freeze. And I grew up on the banks of the river. And I remember as a kid, the winters where it froze, we would go out and stand on the river and just watch this huge waterway be frozen. And then you have to imagine what it would be like in the 18th century to have to live through a winter like that and fight a war. And it's unbelievably, incomprehensibly brutal. So there's that, and I think you want to bring that to life. There's beautiful quote by, you know, is it John Greenwood, right? That had he not turned his body around and around by the fire, he would have frozen to death. And that's the conditions we're living in right now. Henry Knox, who most kids learn about from a school book, has to do this incomprehensible thing and get these cannons from Fort Ticonderoga to Boston. This insane. And like, that's cool and really amazing, but another really wonderful colleague of ours said, I feel like you don't have enough of how this is a civil war and a civil war family. And David found this heartbreaking correspondence between Henry Knox and his wife, Lucy. And I care a lot more about Henry Knox because I know about Lucy. So we're always like the military story of how he gets the cannons. It's the weather. It's a brutal war. But he's got a wife who's pregnant, who's losing her family to the other side. And if you humanize those pieces of it, then I think people listen.
And for me, it's, again, I don't feel like there's something I really miss that's not in the film so much as I wish there were a way people could know more about these people outside of the context of the war. A lot of them have really interesting lives post-war that don't make any sense in this film, but are, you know, maybe I could tell you over a cocktail someday. So I think one of the services I hope that our film provides is to open to viewers a lot of questions that they can dig deeper on their own about these individuals or about whatever battle might interest them or, you know, whatever it might be. It's just many doors that we want to leave for you that you can go open.
We interviewed Elizabeth today, and we both said that we were like on the rewind button because we would hear things that were just so amazing and things that we hadn't really heard before. And so I was also like, I was on that rewind to hear it again.
And you know, the one thing you brought forward, which I think is important, is we always hear Benedict Arnold, you know, and like traitor, that's it, you know, jump to that. And he has a whole story that is very interesting. And, you know, I'm pretty much of a history buff, and I was sort of aware of his service, but that really brought, and that's just one example in the film that you brought things to light. Of course, I'm a big John Adams fan. You know, I think sometimes, I think now he's got his own, but I think he's now credited with how much he really moved us to get to the Declaration and everything like that. Not just because of the musical 1776, which is actually kind of a composite of him and Sam Adams, but I mean, the correspondence between him and Abigail. And
yeah,
it's amazing that whole thing exists in that context.
What a gift to history that they were separated through the war.
I know. So
they could send each other letters.
And yet, not too many years apart, he was on the list to be hung if he was captured. And a few years later, he's the ambassador to England standing before the king. I think that's just such a tremendous, you know, quirk of history. And of course, him along with Thomas Jefferson dying on the same day, July 4th.
Yeah. It's like, how could this be true?
And Samuel Adams, like in 2026, he would be a social media influencer provocateur.
Totally.
You know? I mean, if this be treason, make the most of it. I mean,
totally. Like,
in working on a project, you know, with Ken, and I watched his interview with on NBC just as a precursor. I would imagine, and you can speak as I'm sure you would, that working with him, he's very collaborative. I mean, he just seems very open and very much that way. Tell me about the process working with Ken, because I mean, he's really made a landmark in the documentary style, and especially, you know, I think Civil War was a real breakthrough, even though he did documentaries before that were actually quite good. But tell us about that collaborative process with Ken.
Yeah, three decades says a lot.
It is very collaborative. He's wonderful to work with. We have a really wonderful group of people who've worked together for a very, very long time. And then some of the younger people come and go. And that's also fun and interesting and exciting. I think one of the things that is amazing about working with Ken is that he's extremely decisive and extremely sure of himself and extremely clear-minded as a director. And then he's also really flexible, and you can convince him why what he thinks isn't right. And you can, it's a big, we bring our best debate game to the editing room, all of us. And it's really, really fun. And we're constantly trying to figure out, everybody is in service of making the film better.
Right.
And that's how we collaborate. So I talk a lot about this whenever I talk about my work, particularly with young people, that one of the reasons I love the art of filmmaking is that it is not a solitary. I could not be Jeff Ward and sit, or David, who's also just a little bit of a writer-minded person, can sit alone in Portland and like really think of great ways to bring history to life on paper. I need to like make a fix it. David always says, I need to fix a puzzle every day, and I need a lot of brains to do that. And I love the messiness and the thrill you get from, you know, collaborating and rowing a boat in the same way.
Right. Smelling the candle wax.
Yeah, I love that. And I think Ken does too. And so there's enormous respect. There's enormous, you know, we have a good time. And
I didn't feel, I never feel any competition in this, because we all have trust in each other that we're, you know, listening to each other and that we all want the film to be the best. And, you know, we need Ken to be decisive, because I equivocate, at least I very much equivocate. Sarah's much more decisive than I am. But he listens to both of the sides of my brain that are arguing it out. And he's like, yeah, well, you should pick that one. But he, you know, even if he doesn't agree with what I've got to say, I feel listened to. And that you can't ask for anything more than that.
I think we all have enormous respect for each other, and that comes to every aspect of the job.
You're listening today on Art in the Air to our guests who are the co-directors on Ken Burns' American Revolution, Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So, Sarah, how did you, and Ken also, how did you feel about the reenactment, like the actual, like in the moment? Did it feel right and good? And when it was all done, are you really happy with the results?
I mean, I'm amazed at how Jane Kamensky said this in a screening. The film is beautiful and kind of seamless. And you touched on this in one of your earlier questions. It's a mishmash of material.
Yeah.
It's really wacky what we did. Like, truly, beautiful. Like, it's have a sense of humor, but it's like, okay, some parchmenty document from 1768 mashed into a painting from 1920, mashed into another
contemporary
3D map, mashed to a watercolor.
It's like mixed media collage.
It is, but it gorgeous. It somehow makes sense, and you're subliminally.
It's very cohesive.
It's cohesive, which if we'd been interviewed before we put everything into the editing room, I don't think we would say, oh, it's going to be a mixture of this and that. And I think, we got better at shooting the reenactments as we went, because we could really begin to see what worked and feel what worked. And some of it are like happy accidents. My favorite shots are the really high drone shots, which Buddy initially was like, what are you talking about? I mean, some of that happened because of park regulations where we couldn't fly the drone low. And I said, imagine you're God in the sky. That's what we're going to film. And it really, really works. And our editor, Trisha Rita, was like, oh, this is amazing. And
I thought that had no shot of working.
Right. And David was really wrong. He was like, that's just, don't do that. And I was like, that's
it's going to look like a video game.
Right.
No, it works.
He was like, yeah. And it's really amazing. Same with the film before this set we made was The U.S. and the Holocaust. And we shot a lot of that during the height of COVID, which meant we were directing on WhatsApp in Poland with Polish cinematographers whom we'd never met. And they really understand how to use drones in a way that we hadn't ever done before. I personally learned a lot from that. Making that film taught me a lot about how to see space and buildings and places. And we took that into the 18th century. And so by the end of the project, whenever we had a camera, we had three cameras. We had a big camera on sticks. We had a camera flying through the air, and Buddy built a rig and would, get in uniform and kind of in bed with the guys to feel much more kind of, movement. And all of that worked. But we didn't know that. It was, making a film like this is a good example that you can't do things quickly. You can't make art quickly. You can't write history quickly. There's plenty of room for people to do those things quickly. But what we do takes time.
So, you also had the opposite where in the photos that were sent, there were the camera person in costume on the ground filming as well. I mean, that was like such a beautiful.
It's a great shot. And we didn't do that at the beginning. We didn't know we were going to need that. And,
we also basically never said like, okay, Buddy, go to this battlefield so that we could fill this spot in the script. It was just film what's going on. I mean, it's almost like we almost used the reenactment footage the way we would use archival footage for Vietnam.
Right.
It's like, how does this found footage help us tell this story? It's not really found because we went out and shot it, but the editors kind of treated it as such.
My question too is kind of a technical one. Is Buddy still shooting on film or in video at this
time? It's really sad. We stopped shooting on film. We held out as long as I think literally anybody. Even when we started Vietnam, we were trying to shoot live still with a film camera. But no, we shoot in digital zeros and ones, as much as I hate to admit it. Yeah.
You sound like disappointed in that.
Well, how could I say this? Again, to the craft and the art of it. The first film I worked on was Jazz, and we still shot on film and we cut on film. We cut a 20-hour film in the 1990s on film. We had an entire editing house that was just tiny trims and bins. And I'm so glad I got trained that way. people liken it to writing something on a typewriter, and I get that, but not really. You really understand sync, that you see the sprocket come together and how to sync an interview. You understand that there's 24 frames in a second of film. You understand how to slow something down, what it means to speed it up. You have to really think about how to frame an archive because you're filming that archive. You're not scanning it and trying seven moves to see which one works. You have to really think. And so I'm glad I had that training.
Could carry over to the digital world, though? I mean,
I think for those of us who, Buddy and Ken and me, who are older than everyone, all the digitally native people, I mean, I still walk around and I love still photography and developed stuff in a darkroom. So I see things in a frame.
Right.
I think Ken and Buddy do too. And I've learned a lot from the younger people who can move quickly through a digital world. We use both.
I think that part of what I was talking about earlier about not being very decisive, I know a lot of that's just personality based, but I actually think some of that comes from just how much has been available to me my whole career, how I can try things a bazillion times. You know, if I didn't have so many chances to try something, then I'd be, okay, look, we've got it the best we can. Let's do it. Print. And that would save so much time. So again, I do think it takes all comers. You need people who think differently about this stuff to get the best quality work out there. But I don't know. I think there's probably something to it about the medium that we were each working in when we started our careers.
Yeah. In case there's a young documentary filmmaker in the making listening to this, what advice would you get them about how to start? Now, obviously, your things are more historical based, but share that, both Sarah and David.
I would try to make films about things you don't know about so that you can kind of use that process and journey of discovery. And I don't mean like David knew a lot about the 18th century, but he didn't really, he started anew. So don't make a film thinking you know what you're making the film about. Try to shed your knowledge and have the film be a process of discovery. Never be so sure you're right. Find the argument to your thesis. I think you need to have many varied voices in a film, a documentary, no matter what you're making that documentary about. So I think, you know, again, take your time and poke a hole in your argument.
So was there and it might be an impossible question, I don't know, with this documentary, American Revolution, was there a revelation for you? I mean, there were so many for me as I was watching it, but
yeah, there are a bunch. I say about myself that I am really bad at remembering what I used to not know, but I will say that, look, the American Revolution is something that all of us have some passing knowledge of before we even really remember what we remember, our first memory, basically. You know, it's on our flag, it's the 4th of July, it's on our currency. It's a big part of us. But even knowing now that, even growing up in Colonial Williamsburg, even studying American history, I think I wasn't quite aware of what should almost be obvious by looking at a calendar. If the war begins in 1775, in April of 1775, and they don't declare independence until over a year later in July of 1776, the war did not begin as a war for independence. Mm-hmm. Independence was a product of the war. Union was an outcome of the war, or something that was required to make the war winnable. And the nation itself was not the goal from the start. Mm-hmm. So I think all of those things, which we think are what this war was about, were rather caused by the war rather than causing the war. And that was new to me.
And I'll say two quick things because I know we're almost out of time. I think the great unexpected thing for me to take away is that this is a great underdog story in world history. It was completely unlikely that we were going to do what we did and win. It developed over time into some of the myths that we see and understand now. We didn't win alone. It was a world war that sat on the global stage that, as David said, took a really long time. And the founders debated and debated and debated all the way along. What kind of a country, what kind of a government, what were we doing and what we were up to. And those debates are useful. I never thought the film would be as helpful to understanding American history as I do right now because of the way that they were trying to figure out what was happening as it was happening. And I think that is a surprise.
100%. It very much hurt to watch both the war as history and in real time. You know, it was like very painful.
Yeah, I mean, there are people just like us who lived through incredibly uncertain times and they didn't know how it was going to go. And I think that is both terrifying and reassuring that we don't know how anything is going to go for us either.
Right.
Well, we only have a few moments left. Quickly, any projects coming up?
We're both working on a film about LBJ's presidency, which is super fun. Penn has a number of other projects. So we're just getting our sea legs and back into the 1960s.
Okay. Well, there's more material there, too. We appreciate you coming on Art of the Air, sharing your co-directing on Ken Burns' American Revolution at Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us and really appreciate it. I know we learned a lot today from your process.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both very much.
It was really fun.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Did you know that you can also listen to Art on the Air anytime as a podcast at Lakeshore Public Media's website, through Lakeshore's app, or from NPR? Plus, it's available on demand from your favorite podcast website, including TuneIn, Spotify, Amazon Music, Pandora, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, and many more. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP, 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.